This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, anti-war activists have long called for the United States to cut back its military budget. But the United National Anti-War Coalition is going a step further, demanding specifically that Washington close down its 1,000 military bases around the planet. And criminal justice reform activists warn Attorney General Sessions that the last thing the U.S. needs is more prisons.
But first, by almost unanimous votes, both houses of the U.S. Congress have passed harsh economic sanctions against Russia, Iran, and North Korea. The lawmakers went a step further, forbidding the administration from removing these sanctions without first getting permission from Congress. President Trump reluctantly signed the bill, although he complained that parts of it were unconstitutional. Historically, the U.S. Congress has rarely used its powers to curb presidents from making war, but now prevents presidents from moving toward peace by removing sanctions. We spoke with Dr. Gerald Horn, the prolific author and professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston.
Well, it's a very complicated situation. Obviously, it's bleeding into the investigation of Mr. Trump and his pre-November 2016 connections to Moscow. Let me point you to a cover story in the current issue of the New Republic, which makes credible claims about Mr. Trump's ties to Russian organized crime, not only in terms of buying real estate properties, but perhaps possibly in terms of money laundering as well. This is rather curious happening in the United States of America when we think of all of those who were persecuted. I think of Paul Robeson, for example, a subject of a recent biography I wrote, who was tormented because of his ties to Moscow, and yet the white right yawns and looks the other way when credible allegations are put forward with regard to Mr. Trump's ties to Russian organized crime. But in a certain sense, this is a part of a kind of incoherence that has descended upon Washington. For example, when Mr. Trump signed reluctantly the bill on Russian sanctions, which, by the way, also carries sanctions concerning North Korea and Iran, he issued a signing statement basically disagreeing with the bill that he was signing along the lines that you were just sketching. That is to say, the Constitution basically giving the president a certain latitude in executing U.S. foreign policy. But the incoherence is magnified when you think of the fact that his vice president, as he spoke, was touring Eastern Europe, beating the anti-Moscow drum. And this comes shortly after major war games played out in Romania, a former Moscow ally during the Cold War, some of the largest war games that have taken place in human history, featuring crack U.S. troops from Fort Carson, Colorado, obviously targeting Moscow and Russia. Of course, there were also rather interesting military maneuvers, naval maneuvers, that took place off the Baltic coast of Europe during the same time period, featuring the Navy of Russia and the Navy of China as well, operating jointly. This was not the first time they have had joint naval maneuvers, although obviously the Chinese Navy had to sail a long way to get to the Baltic coast of Europe. This may shed light on why Germany is prodding the European Union to retaliate against sanctions on Russia, because this will hamper the ability of Germany and certain EU allies to receive natural gas from Russia. And I would imagine that the sight of the Russian and Chinese Navy off the Baltic coast, which of course is part of the territorial waters of Germany, helped to concentrate the minds wonderfully of leaders in Berlin. when we raise the question of natural gas, this helps to expose part of the subterranean agenda of this conflict between the United States and Russia, because, of course, the United States, particularly Texas, is a major exporter of natural gas. I would point your listeners and readers to the record of T. Boone Pickens, a proud Texas energy mogul and alumnus of Oklahoma State University, who is deeply invested in natural gas. I would also ask listeners, or perhaps an enterprising journalist, to look at the record of Chesapeake Energy based in neighboring Oklahoma, whose CEO, Aubrey McClendon, died mysteriously last year. It was thought to be suicide. His firm also is a major player in natural gas markets. And by the way, Chesapeake Energy is also a major, if not the controlling investor in the Oklahoma Thunder basketball team, for any sports fans in the audience. But on a more serious note, this is a serious escalation. I don't think we should totally dismiss the possibility of these war games actually becoming real conflict. And I say that as well because also during the month of July 2017, you had a confrontation in the Persian Gulf between Iranian forces and U.S. naval forces. This comes in the wake of the New York Times reporting that President Trump wants to break out of the anti-nuclear agreement negotiated between Secretary of State John Kerry and President Obama with the Iranian authorities. I doubt if the co-signers of that agreement, which includes Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, will go along with Washington, which could further isolate Washington on the one hand or prod it toward desperate maneuvers on the other. What's happening from 30,000 feet is that we're witnessing the slow and torturous decline of U.S. imperialism accompanied by the rise of Asia. And keep in mind that Iran is a close ally of China. As a matter of fact, the two countries are collaborating once again in helping to produce natural gas, which your listeners may have gleaned by now is seen as an energy source of the future. And keep in mind as well that just also in the month of July 2017, you had naval maneuvers involving the navies of the United States, India, and Japan, presumably targeting China. This takes place in the context of a standoff on the border between China and India, which has been going on for weeks now and continues as we speak. It's a very serious conflict. Keep in mind that in 1962, there was a war between India and China that fundamentally was resolved in favor of the Chinese. And this brings us to another flashpoint, which is North Korea, which also raises, once again, the question of incoherence. Rex Tillerson, the U.S. Secretary of State, just a few days ago spoke in very soothing terms about Washington's relations with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, saying that the United States was not interested in regime change, that the United States wanted friendly relations with the DPRK, at the same time that U.S. bomber planes were flying over the Korean Peninsula and a U.S. naval flotilla was heading to territorial waters not far distant from the DPRK. Now, the DPRK, if one wanted to place a bet, is probably a prime target when you talk about a coming war in 2017-2018 involving the U.S. military. I say that not only because of these headlines that you read in U.S. newspapers about the DPRK supposedly having developed intercontinental ballistic missiles that can reach with nuclear warheads Alaska, Hawaii, perhaps the U.S. mainland itself, and how the United States sees that as a threat to its survival. Former Bush II administration official John Bolton had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal just the other day counseling regime change in North Korea, accompanied by a Wall Street Journal editorial counseling something similar. I say that these threats have to be taken seriously because the DPRK is also abutting China, the rising rival. The DPRK also abuts South Korea, who has firms like Samsung, which is a challenger to Apple, and Hyundai and Kia, which are challengers to General Motors and Ford. And then the DPRK is not far distant from Vladivostok, a Russian port on the Pacific, which has been the recipient of massive amounts of investment capital, not only from Russia itself, but also from China as well. So Washington sees a conflict with DPRK as helping to generate massive and multiple dividends, which is one of the reasons why the anti-war movement in this country should be more energetic than ever.
Yes, clearly it's not Congress that has forced Trump's hand in terms of provocations against Russia and China and Iran and North Korea, and certainly not against Venezuela, of which the United States is making very loud noises of regime change about.
This is also, I'm afraid, a very serious situation. It has to be seen in the context of Washington's temptation, if not demand, that nations in this hemisphere basically toe the pro-Yankee line, as the former leaders of Honduras, for example, as the previous leaders of Haiti, for example, as Cuba, which has been under a kind of blockade by U.S. imperialism for decades now. Washington feels it's on a roll because in neighboring Brazil, there was the successful attempt to impeach and oust from office Workers' Party President Dilma Rousseff, and then most recently convict her predecessor and possible successor, Lula da Silva, who had been thinking about running for that office again, but this conviction that has now been imposed upon him might hamper his ability to do so. And then in Argentina, you see the Peronista leader, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, stepped down from office, was immediately investigated, and it cannot be ruled out altogether that she may wind up behind bars. In Ecuador, even though we were able to elect a progressive successor to President Correa, he is now squabbling with his vice president, which opens up enormous fields of opportunity for Yankee intervention, which brings us to Caracas, where just recently there was a vote to elect the Constituent Assembly to reframe and remake the Constitution and seek to isolate the raucous opposition, which receives wind and its sails from Washington, D.C. Keep in mind that the situation in Venezuela is even more fraught because the opposition finds that the army, which it is counting upon to pull off a coup d'etat, is not necessarily leaning in that direction after there was an attempt to overthrow the previous president, Hugo Chavez. Mr. Chavez was wise enough to invite to Venezuela Cuban instructors who have served to stiffen the spine of the Venezuelan military. So even though a coup cannot be ruled out altogether, it is certainly more difficult and more problematic today than it would have been some years ago. And then there's the judiciary, which is basically pro the regime of Nicolas Maduro. And then there's the fact that, like many nations in this hemisphere, Venezuela endured and suffered the enslavement of Africans, and the Afro descendants, generally speaking, are coterminous with the poverty-stricken population, and both of those categories tend to stand in the corner of Mr. Maduro, which makes a regime change, which is the order of the day in Washington, a bit more difficult than it would be ordinarily, let me point your audience to an article in the current issue of Business Week, which paints, accidentally, I would say, a damning picture of the opposition, which protests all day in the chic neighborhoods of Caracas and then parties all night with U.S. dollars in fashionable watering holes. But this is a profoundly serious situation unfolding in South America. And once again, there is the energy question that is a hovering above all others. Venezuela is a major oil-producing nation, by some estimates, even exceeding that of Saudi Arabia. Venezuela also exports oil to the United States, and if Washington is so capricious and so bold as to slap sanctions on the oil industry, so far the sanctions have mostly been imposed on the leaders of Venezuela, you can expect the price of oil to go up in the United States of America, that is to say the price of both heating oil and petroleum or gasoline for one's vehicle. This is taking place at the same time where some analysts are suggesting that we're moving into a post-petroleum era. Recall that Volvo, now controlled by Chinese interests, says that within a few years it will be moving away from the internal combustion engine, which relies upon gasoline. General Motors and Ford and other auto giants have suggested something similar. It is unclear what impact this will have on the international petroleum market, but certainly it will have impact not only on Angola and Saudi Arabia and Nigeria, but also Venezuela, also Russia, a major oil producer, and also the United States of America, where in the state of Texas, once again, there has been a real ramp up in petroleum production. And it is felt amongst right-wing Texas oil men that the United States can get a stranglehold over Venezuelan oil, then Texas and the United States will be in the pole position to dominate what remains of the oil industry going forward. Now, keep in mind that petroleum is not only heating homes and fueling cars. There is a massive petrochemical industry. In fact, in Houston, Texas, in the Ship Channel, as we speak, perhaps the largest petrochemical manufacturing plant in the world is now in the process of being constructed. Neighboring Louisiana also has massive petrochemical plants. Needless to say, these are environmental disasters. But in any case, petrochemicals are used for everything from making toys to making mattresses. So even if we're entering the post-petroleum era with regard to automobiles, there will still continue to be a market with regard to petrochemicals, and that helps to underscore and underline the importance of what's going on in Venezuela, a major oil-exporting nation. But I should add one more point, which is that even if Washington is so bold and so capricious as to slap sanctions on Venezuelan oil, ironically enough, this may only serve to hasten the incipient decline of U.S. imperialism, because those oil exports will probably then be shifted to China, China being a nation which, by the way, has just endorsed the Maduro regime's attempt to frame a constituent assembly to write a new constitution.
On the U.S. domestic front, we see the Trump administration sending out, well, we can't even call them dog whistles. They're much, much louder than that to his right-wing constituency. He has the Justice Department doing a study of affirmative action, signaling an assault against it. He's encouraged quite loudly police to brutalize prisoners. Just putting Ben Carson in charge of housing and Jeff Sessions in charge of the Justice Department is a huge rightward step. In many ways, it looks like the Trump administration has more in common with Woodrow Wilson, who brought Jim Crow to Washington, to the federal bureaucracy, than even with Richard Nixon and his Southern strategy.
Well, you are correct. This is not a dog whistle. It's shouting through a megaphone. You are also correct when you excoriate Jeff Sessions. Putting him in charge of the Justice Department is like having Dracula guard the blood bank. Mr. Trump and Jeff Sessions are pandering to the worst impulses of the Trump base by launching this attack on affirmative action. Recall that sociologists have been telling us for some time now that the Trump base basically sees themselves as the real and hard-working Americans, and the rest of us as officious interlopers, that they are the makers, we are the takers. And from their point of view, this had been the case until Donald J. Trump was elected in November 2016, and now the time has arrived to turn back the clock. But in essence, we can connect our previous discussion with this current discussion, because both involve what we see when one witnesses the unwinding of a massive empire and when one witnesses the incipient decline of U.S. imperialism. That is to say that the easy super profits are rapidly not as prevalent as they may have been some decades ago, and both Mr. Trump and his imperialist supporters and his non-imperialist supporters, if I can use that term, that is to say his working class and middle class base, are both afflicted with a fear of what is to come as U.S. imperialism has one foot on a banana peel. Now, if you look at the Affordable Care Act and the recent debate in Congress about that inadequate piece of legislation, what is striking is that the Trump base was hostile to the Affordable Care Act, which led to Republican gains in 2010, 2012, 2014, and finally in 2016. But as the spotlight was shown on what has been called Obamacare, many in the Trump base came to recognize that their grandparents were heavily dependent upon Medicaid, and Medicaid expansion was at the heart of the Affordable Care Act, that their grandparents' nursing home fees were paid for via Medicaid, and grandma and granddad could be tossed out into the gutter if their allies, if their congresspersons had voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which is why you had this last-minute change of heart by Senator John McCain of Arizona in particular, who turned literally thumbs down on repealing Obamacare, although since Mr. Trump sees that it's necessary for him to have a, quote, win, unquote, on the scoreboard, we cannot rule out the Affordable Care Act being returned and this nation's health care plummeting precipitously as a direct result. Now, with regard to this attack on affirmative action, this is even more curious because Mr. Trump was a beneficiary of rich man affirmative action, which is the norm and the custom in the United States of America. That is to say that he was a middling student in the mid-1960s at Fordham University in New York City, when his affluent father pulled some strings that got him admitted as a transfer student to the Ivy League University of Pennsylvania. That is the normal course of things with regard to what could be called affirmative action. Legacy admissions, for example, Mr. Trump's children then get a leg up to get admitted to this Ivy League school in Philadelphia because their father graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. That is also a kind of affirmative action, which, by the way, locks in generations of bias and discrimination, because we know that black and brown youth in particular have been barred from Ivy League schools for generations up until recent times. So what Mr. Trump and Mr. Sessions are telling us, perhaps, and this is what we're presumably careening towards, is that it's okay for a university to seek diversity in terms of geography, having students from Montana and North Dakota. It's okay to seek diversity in terms of having musically inclined students so that there will be a marching band during football games. It's okay to recruit students who want to study or improve their Spanish so that Romance language teachers can have something to do in the classroom. It's okay, of course, to seek diversity in terms of athletic skills, that is to say swimming or water polo, etc. But it's not okay to seek diversity in terms of recruiting students from oppressed nationalities. This, of course, would mean and mark a return to the Jim Crow era, if not something worse.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn speaking from the University of Houston.
This year, President Trump submitted to Congress the biggest military budget in the history of the United States. The Republican-controlled Congress then added on even more money with the support of the leadership of the Democratic Party. The war budget funds not only nuclear weapons systems that can destroy all human life many times over, but the most massive network of overseas bases that the world has ever seen. UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, has joined with other peace organizations to demand that these bases be shut down, all 1,000 of them. Sarah Flounders sits on UNAC's executive committee. She says the United States is attempting to militarily occupy the planet.
That's right. This is an enormous, enormous theft from the people right here in the U.S., from poor and working people, to finance a vast, intrusive empire around the world. And these bases are total control of the economy, the social, and the political life of countries all over the world. So any campaign which is really talking about U.S. wars and U.S. interventions has to address the role of the foreign military bases and the aircraft carriers, which are huge floating military bases.
Yes, you can't say that you're against U.S. imperialism without saying that we should dismantle the infrastructure of imperialism.
And the infrastructure of U.S. imperialism is far larger than anyone can even conceive. More than 1,000 military bases around the world. And there are all different ways of evaluating this. There's some people that argue, no, it's 900, and others that it's far over 1,000, and some that it's in 70 countries, and others that say U.S. has military personnel and establishments in 130 countries. So it depends on how you're counting, because so much is secret. It's important to even recognize that they refuse to count any of the bases in countries where they're involved actively in wars. So all of the figures are distorted and kept secret, and yet we know it disrupts the local economies, causes huge environmental damage. And then there's the nuclear weapons and nuclear-powered ships and all of this. So this is a devastating, distorting impact on every country in the world and completely distorts life here in the U.S. Every one of these aircraft carriers prowling the seas and, for example, right off in the Persian Gulf, right off the coast of Iran, or against the People's Korea, right off the coast, carrying out nuclear war games again and again with ships that can fire nuclear weapons that literally could end life on Earth in one launch. And then they dare to talk about People's Korea being a threat. Every one of these overflights and every one of these bases, whether it is in South Korea or throughout the Gulf states or in Kuwait to Saudi Arabia or throughout Europe, we should recognize every one of even the G7 countries as NATO powers, or thinking about Japan also, where the 100 U.S. bases are really countries that are both occupied, they're allies, but they're considered competitors, and they are kept on a short leash with a lot of U.S. bases. NATO is a U.S.-commanded, U.S.-equipped military alliance. So the bases play an enormous role in creating the infrastructure and the threat on countries around the world.
And every time a country joins NATO, it becomes interlocked with the U.S. military infrastructure.
Yes, it becomes linked in ways, 101 ways, both the obvious, every one of these bases in turn finances, whether it's through NGOs, whether it's through trade agreements and free trade agreements, the life of the country itself, destroying any even pretense of sovereignty. And U.S. forces around the world in these bases, there's status of forces agreements, meaning they can't be prosecuted for any crime they commit. And the crimes are endless. So that's a real part of it, too. Now, there are coalitions around the world that we are really linking up with that are talking about bases, whether it's in Okinawa, there's a movement against bases in South Korea, especially Jeju Island, or the THAAD missiles. There's a movement against bases in Italy and in Greece and in Germany. So there are many, many different groups around the world that are raising the demand of U.S. bases out. And linking up with them is a way of building new threads of international solidarity to show that there's a movement right here in the U.S. which is standing up and demanding these bases end. So it very much links with the troops out now, but it makes it more real in another way.
Spokespersons for U.S. foreign and military policy are always talking about the necessity for the U.S. to be able to project power. But power projection sounds like a euphemism for intimidation and coercion and threats of war. And, of course, threats of war and coercion and intimidation are actually aggressions themselves.
Endlessly. They are, in terms of whether it's the ability to carry out a coup or change the vote in a legislature or impose sanctions on a country, the threats are endless. And it's a constant reminder who's the big power, who's the decider. And this is distorting life on an international basis. We have to see how big a threat it is. And it's carried out also with a huge increase in political repression right here at home. A huge increase in the level of prisons and police and racist attacks, because this infrastructure globally is reflected right back here. It doesn't just exist on another side of the world. It's right here too.
In terms of foreign legions, everybody knows about the French Foreign Legion, but there's never been a foreign legion in the history of the world like the American Foreign Legion.
And that's so true. You know, there was a time when they said, well, the sun never sets on the British Empire. But there was never even any projection, any possibility of this level of military apparatus. And none of these countries are called colonies, and yet every effort is made to completely subjugate and distort political and social cultural life in the countries where, that are really under occupation. There's no other way to look at it. Not one of these bases is carrying out any progressive contribution to life on any basis whatsoever.
Probably the most famous U.S. base in the world is at Guantanamo Bay, in a country that doesn't want it there.
And the very fact that they placed in Guantanamo their prison, which was for people kidnapped from around the world, 95% of them, they had no information on whatsoever, and yet they've been held now, this has gone on 16 years, their force is still held at Guantanamo. What a distortion. And Cuba, from the very beginning of the Cuban Revolution, has denounced and demanded back this land. Of course, even to look at it, I believe it was a 100-year agreement, which would have meant 1999, but once the U.S. is there, they don't leave. And they make no bones about it. There's no discussion about their departure.
There are all kinds of warfare. Sometimes warfare is waged with weapons that don't go boom, weapons like sanctions.
And sanctions are perhaps the most egregious, silent form of killer, because what happens is the population can blame their own government for the huge shortages in food and social programs. That's what it's meant to do. It's meant to turn people against each other. It's a very sophisticated program. And we could look at the new round of sanctions imposed by both political parties, Democrats and Republicans, against Russia and Iran and the DPRK, People's Korea. Or we could look back at the sanctions imposed against Iraq, responsible for the death of more than a million people. And the U.S. gloated over those figures. They were UN figures. They were widely published. We could look at the sanctions on Iran for decades, or the sanctions on Syria since 2003. Every one of those are meant to, for the government that's in office, to make every possibility of a distorted economy and wild inflation and unemployment to try to bring them down. It's about regime change. Any government they feel isn't following exactly their dictates will come under first sanctions and then attempts at military intervention. That's what we see in Syria today. It's certainly what we saw in Libya, where there were years and years of sanctions. So countries that refuse bases face an enormous risk, as we see in Venezuela today, or we can look at Ecuador, which big accomplishment to boot out U.S. base there. And it leaves countries facing, they're up against a huge monster when they do that, and yet they're asserting their own sovereignty and their own right to development. And it has meant a huge difference in the living standards of the whole population when they're able to break free, even for a short time, the stranglehold of Wall Street and corporate power.
The sanctions bill that was passed by the U.S. House and by the Senate almost unanimously got the support of even Barbara Lee and Tulsi Gabbard, two of the representatives most associated with anti-war behavior.
That's right. And it really shows here that everyone in the country and all the media was talking about saving the Affordable Care Act, and you have Democratic Party politicians really grandstanding about that. A very feeble and weak health program. It's not single payer. It's not health care for all. But that was where all the attention was focused. And at the same time, they're voting almost unanimously for a whole new round of extreme sanctions and provisions in it that make the sanctions almost impossible to lift. There would have to be agreement from the Congress on all three countries to lift any of these sanctions. And it has raised really enormous anger within Europe, who had military contracts with both Russia and with Iran. It's an effort to force every country in the world to buy its oil and natural gas from the fracking industry, the oil corporations in the U.S. So it's strong-handed tactics that are becoming harsher and harsher. And this is recognized even in Congress. Politicians who want to stay in office know that they're going to vote for one tiny little package of good things here. They go along with U.S. war and the military. They vote again and again for the military appropriations, and it's just silently done. This year, Congress increased enormously the military budget that Trump sent to them, which was already the largest on record, historic high, and they further increased it. That's the power of lobbyists to get even more contracts in this push back and forth. So we can ask ourselves, why would these politicians, which seem to represent people right here in the U.S., have a base in a community, seem to speak against war and for protecting certain social programs, why do they do this? And it's because they know the cost if they don't. They won't survive another term. Multi-million-dollar campaigns will be run to unseat them. So it is a vote for pay, a compromise made again and again by every politician in the U.S. Many politicians look at what was publicly done, for example, to Cynthia McKinney. If she would support Palestine, well, then there's a whole lobby to push her out of office and provide the funds to do so. So this is something that I think other, certainly in the Black Congressional Caucus, will be votes for military appropriations and for sanctions, knowing the cost if they don't. And it's what politicians around the world face. You think, why again and again? The countries go along with sanctions against one targeted country. They're trying to keep out of the crosshairs themselves. And in that way, it distorts political life, too. It means that everyone in the world is making very brutal compromises in order to try to keep their head above water as others are being pulled down. Breaks up solidarity. And it's important for the movement here to be free of both political parties, because they're both for imperialist war, and try to build a movement that is focusing on these wars and these bases. Now, this new effort, the coalition against U.S. foreign military bases, is quite an important effort because a number of political groupings, anti-war groupings, including UNAC, United National Anti-War Coalition, but also the Peace Council, who had a big role in helping develop this U.S. Peace Council, Veterans for Peace, Black Alliance for Peace, Code Pink, and Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. I could go on. It's a good list of initial endorsing organizations, and then hundreds and hundreds of anti-war activists and organizations who've signed on. So anytime a coalition is able to focus attention on U.S. war and U.S. bases, that's a big step forward, because all of the attention is always to look anywhere else. Don't look at what is happening right here. Blame everyone else. Let's all be fearful of People's Korea. Let's all be fearful of Iran. Be fearful of Russia, country no longer, right? They'll use the term superpower against Russia again and again. Here's a country where the economy is smaller than Brazil or smaller than South Korea, and yet is always being turned into an enormous threat. So the U.S. wants to turn the attention of the people here into threats around the world, and we've got to always respond by finding new ways to say, no, the threat comes right here from the Pentagon and from Wall Street.
There are lots of folks out there calling themselves the resistance to Trump, but if you're not resisting the war budget and the war party, then you're guaranteeing continued austerity and all the things that you associate with Trump.
And that's so true. So much of this resistance to Trump is totally phony, because if anything, they want to pull things to the right. I mean, who could have imagined a few months back that the election of Trump, you would have the Democrats demanding and pushing hard for a whole campaign against Russia, pushing hard against People's Korea, saying they want real war and regime change in Syria. But this is where they want to turn the attention, while really putting up almost no fight in Congress. As I say, even okay, they're maybe going to preserve the Affordable Care Act. Will they take even that a step further? No. So they're not putting up any resistance to Trump. In essence, their campaign, their program, which was equally bad, is sailing right through with total support, overwhelming, almost unanimous support on militarism and war. And on cutbacks, because when you have the biggest military budget in U.S. history, in world history, passing, and then you have to balance a budget, what's going to be cut? You can say you want to preserve health care and Medicaid and Medicare here and education, but even every state budget is bankrupt because there's not enough money. They all know the consequences of voting for that military budget. And yet, a majority of Democrats, along with the Republicans, voted just that way.
UNAC isn't by itself in calling for the U.S. to withdraw from its 1,000 bases and to abandon this huge military budget. You've got allies.
Yes, there are actually a number of viable organizations really struggling for peace and for resistance and against U.S. wars who are signed on. The founding organizations include the Black Alliance for Peace and Code Pink, the International Action Center, my organization, the Martin Luther King Justice Coalition, Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, I could go on, Popular Resistance. The U.S. Peace Council played a big role in pulling together this coalition. Veterans for Peace, very much part of it. World Against War. And then there are hundreds of endorsing organizations and individuals. So focusing the attention of the movement against war on the greatest cause of war is very important. Let's not blame countries, other countries all around the world. We've got to always focus the attention, bring back the demands, the struggles, the unifying statements to the threat of U.S. war and this monstrous infrastructure imposed on the whole world at a cost of trillions of dollars. So people can get a lot more information. NoForeignBases.org. There's plans to hold a conference really focused on this in January. There's a lot of groups connecting with each other on how, again and again, to turn these questions around and do it in a way that doesn't rely on the politicians that always vote for the war and the media who tells us war and sanctions and threats are the only way forward. We have to resist that and fight it and link to the struggles right here at home.
That was Sarah Flounders of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions claims that crime has gone up in several U.S. cities because the Obama administration wasn't imposing harsh enough prison sentences. Mark Maurer, the executive director of the Sentencing Project in Washington, says Sessions' lock them up and throw away the key approach is counterproductive and socially destructive.
Well, Attorney General Sessions has had a long career that's been manifested by his commitment to essentially being tough on crime, as the old saying goes. It's particularly notable at a moment when other conservatives, other Republican leaders of his generation as well, some are beginning to accept the need for some type of reform in the criminal justice system. We can contrast it with somebody like Senator Grassley of Iowa, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee. He, too, has been very conservative, still is very conservative, and espoused tough-on-crime policies for much of his career, and over the last couple of years has now embraced some aspects of federal sentencing reform. To be fair, the Attorney General Sessions in 2010 supported the Fair Sentencing Act, which was the federal legislation that reduced but did not eliminate the sentencing disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. It took 24 years after the enactment of that policy for Congress to finally amend it somewhat, and it was reasonably bipartisan at the time. But with that single exception, everything Mr. Sessions has done has been the old tough-on-crime agenda, including certainly his actions since he's been Attorney General, but also in the Senate in the last couple of years, being one of the key Republican holdouts to any type of sentencing reform.
Yeah, there seems to have developed what some folks consider to be a kind of consensus that unites people that are described as liberal and conservative around the necessity to cut down on the prison population.
Yeah, it's not an across-the-board consensus about all the elements of ending mass incarceration, and it's not an across-the-board understanding of where this comes from. Nonetheless, for the first time in several decades, we do have, in the political leadership, you can see key liberals and key conservatives echoing and supporting similar changes in sentencing policy and drug policy and the like. I think this comes about for a number of reasons, but it has opened up the space in the political arena to give a greater comfort level to many mainstream policymakers that signal that it's okay to get on board with supporting this type of reform, and yes, you can still be reelected if you support justice reform. For too many years, they were scared to death they wouldn't be reelected or be accused of being soft on crime, and that's not completely gone, but it's faded much more into the background these days.
Sessions and his political ilk don't seem to be embarrassed at all that the United States has by far the largest prison population in the world.
No, they're certainly not embarrassed about the data. And what's distressing as well is that their policy initiatives seem like their political soundbites rather than any kind of understanding of research and evidence about public policy. Sessions has reversed a number of important policy shifts from the Obama-era Justice Department, initially under Attorney General Eric Holder, and he's offered virtually no argument whatsoever as to why it's necessary to reverse some of these policies. He says that Attorney General Holder didn't prosecute enough drug offenders with enough punishment, and yet he makes no direct connection with any problem that resulted from that. You know, we know that crime rates are down substantially from where they were in the 80s and early 90s, and, you know, many local leaders have embraced these kinds of policies. So it's discouraging 21st century that we're making policy based on sound bites and gut instincts rather than evidence, and there's no lack of evidence to show that mass incarceration has been counterproductive for public safety, has been devastating for low-income communities of color as well.
In your retort to Sessions' piece in the Washington Post, you and Mr. Cole on several points said that Attorney General, former Attorney General Eric Holder's changes in policies shouldn't be seen as the cause of any increases anywhere in crime, because the federal government only handles about 10% of the country's cases. I guess that would also mean that Attorney General Sessions is not going to have an effect, despite his reactionary views, on 90% of the criminal caseload in the country that is handled by the states.
Right, exactly. And yes, the federal government has a role to play in public safety for federal cases. Specifically, you know, the problem with Attorney General Sessions' statements on this is that he claims first that, you know, Eric Holder didn't prosecute enough drug cases sufficiently harshly, and therefore crime rates are going up in Chicago and Baltimore and other cities. Well, what's the direct connection there? For one thing, if you really were critical of the Holder policy, we would expect to be crime exploding all over the country, not just in a handful of cities, and that's not the case at all. And secondly, if the federal government is only prosecuting about 10% of all criminal cases, then 90% are being prosecuted the same way they've always been, and there's no way that a relatively modest shift in federal stuff is possibly going to have an enormous impact on a city the size of Chicago. So there's no understanding about the connection there, the data, or anything like that. Do they understand that within the Justice Department? It's hard to say, but they're certainly not articulating anything that would help us to make sense of that.
And of course, if we followed the logic of Sessions and his ilk, then the immediate summary execution of everyone suspected of being involved in crime would at least temporarily lower the crime rate.
Well, you know, one could make that conclusion or so. You know, they claim to be following the rule of law and they claim to be doing what is mandated by law. But, you know, I think one key misunderstanding is the role of the prosecutor. You know, the roles of the prosecutor by professional standards, by ethical standards, is the prosecutor is supposed to seek justice. The goal of the prosecutor is not to get a record number of convictions. It's not to get the harshest number of prison sentences, but it's to seek justice. And justice in one case may involve advocating for a prison term. In another case, it may mean they should recommend community supervision. If it's a young single mother with two children, her first drug arrest, and we don't know where the children are going to be if she's incarcerated, those are factors that should be taken into account. Instead, the Sessions policy is basically a one-size-fits-all approach to sentencing. And any judge in the country will tell us that no two offenders, no two offenses are exactly alike. That's why we have judges, and that's why prosecutors are supposed to use their discretion in appropriate ways that respond to the circumstances before them.
It seems that Attorney General Sessions believes that his office is primarily one that magnifies dog whistles.
Well, they certainly are doing that. You know, it's no secret what the extreme racial disparities of the war on drugs have brought us, the disproportionate effect on low-income communities of color around the country, contributing to fragmentation of families and communities in the neighborhoods that are most affected by that. And, you know, what that tells us, what we've learned is that incarcerating record numbers of drug offenders has had very little impact on drug availability, drug pricing, or the like, but it has succeeded in burdening prison systems with enormous costs, and it's also succeeded in greatly limiting the life prospects of people going through the system on these kinds of cases.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.